From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Yes, and number three in the Heavy 100 talkers list. Thanks so much to Michael Harrison. This hour, we're going to be joined by former Trump attorney Tim Pallitore and Bobby Gunn. You might not know him unless you are a bare knuckles boxer, but he's the undefeated, one of the best ever. Dates back in our country to the 1840s. We're going to discuss this little known expertise, one of the toughest men you'll ever meet. He's got a brand new book out, too. But we have a lot of moving parts today, and we're looking to follow all of it. We're looking to follow some of the drama on Capitol Hill, also looking to follow the drama on courts, as well as follow both campaigns. And it's going to be challenging if you're looking to follow the President of the United States. He is back in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. He always goes there. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I have not asked a single Democrat to get involved in that at all. I do not spend time walking around thinking about the motion to vacate. I have a job to do here, and I'm going to do the job.
Yep, that is Speaker Johnson, who for now has that job. He's emerging with a foreign policy package producing both praise and criticism. Will he survive that challenge that is rumored to come from people like Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene, along with border provisions? Is that going to make everyone happy? We're going to follow all the breaking news.
Number two.
No safe place, death to the Zionist state. Jews out. You don't think those are anti-Jewish?
Completely anti-Jewish. Completely unacceptable.
So you changed your testimony on that issue as well? So there have been anti-Jewish protests.
Anti-Jewish things were said at protests, yes.
What the hell is the difference? Dr. Shafik of Columbia and with Elise Stefanik. Running rampant, anti-Semitism, pro-Palestinian protests still raging on Capitol Hill, and pro-Hamas protests, while some elite college presidents try to explain it away on Capitol Hill. Worst of them all, Columbia. They actually were burning things, blocking roads all through the night, all in the name of Palestinians and Hamas. The testimony, the explanations, and the action on a crackdown, which could begin to turn everything around, I hope.
Number one.
How do you speak onto a jury? You have to be called.
Well, you lie. You lie. You say,
yeah, that's
I hate Trump. But I can be impartial.
I do not think this jury is going to remain anonymous necessarily if they keep this up.
You're worried about their safety?
Yeah, I'm worried about their safety.
I mean, they described the seven that have already passed, and of course, they need more. Trump trials, this is case one, day three. We begin with seven jurors selected. Need five more starters and six more subs. We have legal experts inside who will bring you the latest as this story develops. Uphill battle for the former president, no doubt, in New York City, where he got 12% of the vote. So let's talk about it. First off, the president is going to have to be back in court 7 hours. Did they get an hour for lunch? He's going to use to have some press. Hopefully, even though the weather is not great, hopefully he finds another place to go like he did the Bodega Association in Harlem, because it ended up being fantastic for him to go out and point out everything else that Alvin Bragg should be doing except for focusing on a former president for something that happened in 2009, for something they don't like how it was handled in 2016. Check the calendar, it's 2024. And I'm just wondering what kind of jury they have. They seem to be in an awful big rush. If I'm Trump, I want to take my time. But this judge, who I found out, is not a judge that was just in a rotation, randomly selected. He was chosen. Cut one is how the media is just giddy with the prospect of Trump's case. Cut one.
The official name of the trial is the People of the State of New York versus Donald Trump. The People of the State of New York? That's us. Okay, hold on. Hold on. I know you're excited, but don't cheer too loud. We need you to get picked for jury duty.
How do you speak onto a jury? You have to be called.
Well, you lie. You lie. You say,
yeah, that's
I hate Trump, but I can be impartial.
I'm a little surprised that we are learning all of this, because I do not think this jury is going to remain anonymous necessarily if they keep this up.
You're worried about their safety?
Yeah, I'm worried about their safety.
Of course, we didn't know their names. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Tim Pallitore joins us now, former Trump attorney, founder and managing partner of Pallitore Law Group. Tim, welcome back. Your thoughts about the speed in which this jury's been selected, and from what we know about the seven who have made the cut?
You know, it definitely is moving a lot faster than I was expecting. But, you know, from everything I'm hearing about the process, that doesn't necessarily indicate any wrongdoing or any, you know, corner cutting. It does seem like this is, honestly, reading what they talk about these particular jurors that have been picked, it seems to be a very fair and potentially positive jury for the president.
Interesting. Do you think, are they under any compunction to tell the truth? Like, hey, yeah, I watch Fox News and CNN. I read the Washington Post and Daily News. So, there's no penalty for that.
Oh, sure there is.
There is.
If a juror lies to get on a jury, that is something that they could absolutely be prosecuted for, but they would have to be prosecuted by Alvin Bragg's office. So it's unlikely, unless they lied, saying, I'm a lifelong Democrat when really they're a big Trump supporter. But, I think that it is something. Just look recently, the appellate courts overturned the verdict, or not the verdict, the sentence in the Boston Marathon bombers case because a juror failed to disclose, their previous social media activity that was, directly relevant to the case. So it is certainly something that can be an issue on appeal and could potentially, if you lie to get on a jury, you're going into a courtroom and lying to a judge. That does have penalties.
So Tim, do we know everything about the charges on the former president? Isn't there a lot still to be disclosed? And how does that sit with you?
It's bizarre because what he's done is he's taken misdemeanor counts and turned them into felonies based on the theory that, these false business entries were done for the purpose of furthering another crime. And I think that other crime, or what we call the target offense, is something that really hasn't been fully fleshed out yet. And I don't know that Alvin Bragg has really ever said what his full theory on that is. And so that's something that will have to come out, during the case. I mean, it's largely a paper case. What was in the papers is in the papers. That's not going to be any surprise. What their theory is as to the target offense, that remains to be seen.
So
how they're going to possibly prove that Donald Trump knew and participated in that particular accounting entry, that's also something we have no idea.
They threw out the Access Hollywood tape, and they also threw out that Michael Cohen was convicted on campaign finance-related charges. They said that cannot be brought up, and people say that's an advantage for the former president. So, Tim, if this was your case, and this was never your case, right? If this was your case, how do you build the defense? Or a lot of non-lawyers are listening to us right now. So what do you start doing for Trump? Like, what do you hope to – how do you defend him?
Okay, so I see that there are two main weak points in the structure of their case. The first is to try and prove that he knowingly participated in making this accounting entry. And the reality is, when you run a big company like that, you have accountants that do that kind of stuff for you. I mean, I run a law firm with 15 lawyers. It's much, much smaller, and yet I have an accounting staff that does all of my entries. I'm not personally involved in every single one. Donald Trump, to a much greater degree. So how are they going to prove that he participated personally in how they annotated that entry? And then the second part is going to be trying to prove what is that target offense. When they talk about, I know that they love to try calling this the 2016 election interference case, but the reality is whatever you put in the non-public books of a corporation, that has no effect on an election. It's not like if they have written hush money payment in the non-public accounting records of the Trump organization, that would have all of a sudden been public knowledge as part of the campaign. So you're going to have to hit those two points, but then taking a step back from that, the way that they prove that is through the testimony of a guy named Michael Cohen, a convicted perjurer, a known liar. And so ultimately, you're making a false business records case, a case about lying, false statements, based solely on the say-so of somebody who's been convicted for making false statements.
So let me ask you, that's where Hope Hicks' name comes up. And they say that'll be the key witness. She's got a lot of credibility. She's a great person, by the way. And they're going to bring her in, and they're going to say, what do you know? And remember, you're under oath.
And she may say, I don't know anything about that. We have no idea what she's going to say about that.
Has she been deposed?
No, No, there's no depositions in criminal cases.
Okay. So why are people so excited? Why is the prosecution so excited about her presence?
Yeah, you know, I think that a lot of this just comes down to hope, and not hope with a capital H as in the first name, but small h, hope that they will get what they want, and they're trying to get everybody excited, and they want to tell everybody all this stuff. But she's probably going to come in there and say, honestly, I don't remember. That was so many years ago. But, you know, she may talk generally about, you know, what his accounting practices are, that he has these meetings, that they go very quickly, and, you know, he may sit there with the accountant, and, you know, she may talk about that. I don't know. I mean, certainly the people in the media that really want him, you know, those that want him convicted, they're going to try and read anything as being, oh, this is very bad for him. Yeah, and anything that goes against Trump, they say, oh, this is very bad. This is airtight. This is, you know, this is wonderful. You know, regardless of what the actual contents are.
Interesting. So people at home should know, if I'm running for office, and let's say I had owned a restaurant and it ended bad with my partner, and I'm trying to run for office. I don't want my partner coming out speaking bad about me. I could negotiate a deal with him. Just go, hey, sign this NDA. Let's work out a deal. Just keep quiet. There's nothing illegal about that, right?
No, there's nothing. Actually, here's the interesting thing: is this underlying hush money deal?
Yeah.
Michael Cohen's an idiot, and the way that he structured this deal is stupid because Donald Trump did not commit any crime in that, but Stormy Daniels did. Because when you say, "Hey, I have embarrassing information that I'm going to make public unless you pay me," that's called blackmail.
Yeah,
it's textbook definition of blackmail. And so, the fact that they wrote it up as a legal document, for blackmail payment, without obviously using the words, yes, a crime was committed, and Stormy Daniels is going to have to come into that courtroom and admit that she committed a felony. And that, by the way, that's true whether there was sex or not. I mean, that's kind of irrelevant. Whether the embarrassing information is true or false, it does not change the fact that hush money payments, the receiver of that payment is committing blackmail. Yeah, the payer's not. The payer is a victim, is a crime victim. So there's no crime in paying the hush money. But oftentimes these types of cases, they get handled slightly different, whether it's the David Pecker method, or more often what lawyers do is we will couch it in terms of at least some form of a personal injury case or something, that okay, maybe a tiny little part of the sex was rougher than she wanted, and so therefore it's a personal injury settlement that has a confidentiality provision to it. But Michael Cohen just did a straight up blackmail payment, and so
right.
There is criminality to that, but not by the president.
Right. And what about do you think it's at all related that the CFO's in jail, Rikers, and they're killing this 74-year-old literally by the day? Nobody goes to Rikers anymore, even suspected killers, burglars, robbers, carjackers, but they put the CFO in there. Do they not want him to testify? Do they want to make sure he doesn't?
Hold on. That doesn't matter, because the fact that he's in Rikers makes it very easy to produce him. They can just put him on a bus and bring him over.
Gotcha.
They have buses coming from Rikers over to 100 Center Street every single day.
So does it bother you that two lawyers, just on a separate question, does it bother you that two lawyers are on the jury?
It's unique. I'll tell you that. It's unique to have that. I would have to know their specific questions and answers because, I mean, look, honestly, I've put FBI agents on my juries before, which the prosecutors thought I was freaking crazy, but I won with them, because lawyers, agents, people like that, they will take seriously the judge's instructions. And when the judge talks to them about, proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the presumption of innocence, don't consider this evidence, lawyers will take that seriously. Now, the flip side of that is lawyers, because they are lawyers, and particularly the one that's a litigator, is going to be an extraordinarily strong personality in the jury room and can have a tendency to sway the opinions of the other jurors.
Sure.
And so you better hope that Yeah, by putting a lawyer on your jury, you better hope that they are, you know, positive to you. And, you know, it was the same thing when I put that FBI agent on my jury, is I was pretty sure that he was going to be able to tell, you know, the rest of the jurors, hey, this forensic evidence is no good. So it's risky, but depending on their specific answers, it could be a very good thing.
So are you happy with
definitely unusual, though.
Okay. Final question, and we'll have you back, Tim, obviously. Yeah. But do you think sure. The president should feel good about his defense, the lawyers, the quality?
You know, a lot of this will come down to whether they are prepared to call Bob Costello as a witness. I think that...
Who's that?
Yeah, Bob Costello was an attorney for Michael Cohen briefly, and he is the one that when the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney's Office, was evaluating this case, they brought him in. Michael Cohen had to execute a privilege waiver, and he presented the U.S. Attorney's Office with all the information that he had at the time, and based on that, they decided not to bring the case because they knew that they couldn't trust the lies that Michael Cohen was telling about this transaction. And so he is also in a position where he can testify at this trial. He did testify before the grand jury, although Bragg's people prevented him from really telling the story to the grand jury. And so if they don't call Bob Costello in this trial, I believe that that is something that could be raised on an appeal as a reversible error, ineffective assistant counsel by these attorneys.
And, wow, that's interesting. Fascinating time. We'll see you, and we'll see if we get a jury by the end of the week, and we start with opening arguments next week. Tim, thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, former Trump attorney Tim Pollitore with some great analysis. When we come back, we open up this. We open up the phones. We also expand on the other two stories and what Speaker Johnson did yesterday.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, it's amazing what's going on in this campaign. You know, we're talking about civility coming back to the White House. The grown-ups are now in charge. All hell is broken loose in the Middle East. You have a president who's turned on the prime minister of our greatest ally next to the UK, and that is in Israel, and it's happening publicly. But behind closed doors, it's even worse. Punch Bowl today in Axios has this story that they called Donald Trump Hitler pig, right, in email. So they know this is going to be in the record at some point. And they also... President of the United States calls him a sick F and an effing a-hole. They rip him apart all the time behind the scenes. This is the class that they were supposed to bring to the White House. You could just know they will do anything to keep him out of it. And you know how nervous they must be that they are losing.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
At 11 years old, his father would wake him up to fight grown men in parking lots. An abused kid who rose to become a bare-knuckle boxing champion. A father who would do anything to give his daughter a better life. Even betting on himself in the underground world of bare-knuckle boxing. An inspiring underdog story that reads like a real-life Rocky. A dad. A dream. A fight like you've never seen. 73-0, undefeated champion, Bare Knuckle.
And that's where we left off, so let's begin. Bare Knuckle is the name of the book. Bobby Gunn is the name of the guy who is 73-0. He's sitting to my immediate right. He's a dad, a dream, and a fight like you've never seen. And Staten Bonner is the author writing about Bobby Gunn, his family, and his legacy and how we got here. Welcome to both of you guys.
Thank you, Sir Brian.
All right, first off, Bobby, tell me, what is a bare-knuckle boxer? No gloves, right? What's the difference?
Yeah, 100%. Bare-knuckle fighter is like bare-fist boxing, but you have rules. Like, you're kind of boxing. You have a fair play, man, a referee giving fair play. And that's how it was done. But the fights I done, the underground fights, it was organized. there's a referee, a fair play mine, and winner take all. Each man put a certain amount of money up. Like, you put $5,000, I put $5,000. Well, you know you got to win, Brian. You got to go home the winner. You can't go home the loser.
Right.
That's how it was done.
When did you start boxing?
I probably started about, I had diapers on. I was shadow boxing. I think 5 or 6 years old, I had my first amateur fight.
Because your dad did what?
Fighting too. Dad was a fighter. My great-grandfather was a fighter. My grandfather was a fighter. He's born and bred into me. Brian, and I say this a lot. I got my little dog Max here. Like you see my friend
Bulldog.
That's
who's panting in the background.
yes, he won't stop. But all people in the world, they're the same, but there's different people, sir. All dogs have the same DNA, canine bloodline. There's different breeds, Chihuahuas, Poodles, and Pit Bulls. My people, sir, were Pit Bulls. We're born and bred for fighting.
Right.
You know, Tyson Fury is a cousin of mine, heavyweight champion of the world. It's born and bred, all of us like that. It's our life. We're immortalized. We love the fighters.
And just like in normal times, the toughest people are also the nice guys. You are a nice guy.
Oh, thank you.
Who are tough as nails.
Thank you, sir.
So, Staten, what attracted you to this story?
In all my years as a journalist, it's the most amazing story I'd ever come across. I mean, Bobby Gunn is a true life underdog Rocky story. Grew up, his father training him at 11 years old to fight grown men in parking lots for cash. When I met him in 2012, initially I've been reporting this book for 12 years. I went with him around and met his family. He was fighting in illegal underground mob-backed matches for money to put his 7-year-old daughter through private school. And I went with him one morning when he dropped his daughter off at her school. And he came back in the car and he told me, you know, the fights aren't what scare me. I'm always worried dropping her off that one of her friend's parents are going to find out what I do and somehow shun or think less of my daughter. And I said, this is just an amazing person.
So it's not a fighter story. It is a great family
story. It's a father.
It's
a story of a father.
And his father.
It's a story of a father. Bobby came up under very hard circumstances, an incredibly abusive, hard childhood, which he can talk about to harden him as a weapon. And he wanted a better life for his children, and that's what he was fighting for.
So when you say underground, Bobby, you literally underground, out of nowhere, a warehouse could turn into a ring. And these fights last, what, 5 minutes?
There's no rounds. You fight as long as you want. I've seen fights go an hour.
Really? You've had – what's the longest one you've had?
Well, the longest one I had, maybe about 20 minutes. You know, for me, I was a little bit luckier that way. But one time I fought in a plaza. And there was a grocery store right next door. And I mean, in this plaza, the room where we were fighting, there was a newspaper on the floor covered, soaking the blood of fights, maybe 20 fights before me. Can you imagine, like I said all the time, an old woman and her granddaughter walking down aisle 9, oblivious to what's going on right next door. These fights happen, Brian.
People just bet. They put the money down. The fighter's there. You get half the purse usually?
Well, you usually know how it goes. Like the underground fights, the range, winner take all. I put up money and you put money. You want to make money. Or sometimes it's range difference too. Sometimes like the backers, like let's say a certain group backs me, he might put $50,000 up. A group backs out, a guy I'm fighting, they put $50,000 up. I might get like 25 out of that if I win the whole thing.
You know, and a lot of times you got to fight to get your money, right?
Well, you can't go home to my wife with no money. She'll kill me. She's suffering in the fighters I'm fighting. You know what I mean?
So this is happening. It seems like you're describing the 1830s.
Yeah.
But you were doing this in what years are you doing this? Was your dad doing the same thing?
Oh, yeah. I fought all like to 2000s right now. I just retired about 5, 6, 8 years ago. I mean, I retired from it. But, Brian, this has been going on hundreds of years. And it's going on right now, even though the sport is sanctioned. It'll be going 100 years around.
There is bare knuckle boxing, yeah.
Oh yeah, legal sanctioned bare knuckle boxing, and then, like I said, the underground is still going. It's like Charles Bronson, Hard Times, a movie,
which was one of the best movies I ever saw.
Yeah, it was.
So, what makes Bobby great?
I think it's his skill as a pro boxer. He was an IBA world champion in the boxing ring.
Cruiserweight, right?
Yeah, cruiserweight. Just never got his due. He was fighting under Don King's son, Carl King.
That'll do it.
Yeah, never got his chance. And when his mother was dying of hepatitis C due to a bad blood transfusion, Bobby started fighting in underground matches. He'd been fighting bare knuckle for years, since a childhood, obviously, but for real cash. And he immediately started to win. And that got his name around the circuit all across the United States. And that's when he began fighting and growing his legend. But I think he's a champion because he's got such a heart. Lays prostrate on the ground before fighting. It's just very religious. His two main values are religion and fighting. And I think that's given him a champion's heart.
Right. To me, in reading this, you're not in a rage when you fight. You're focused, right?
Yeah, I'm focused. Like, I'm a nice guy. Most fighters, Brian, are proper fight men, are good men. We're not bullies. You know, I'm a bully slayer. Like I said, you know, I like the bullies, but I give you something you need it. I take my shirt off, I give it to someone who needs it. Because I know what it is to go through times when you never had it. But when I focus on a fight, I'm nice right now, but there's a switch.
Right.
Fully focused opponent. And to beat me, Sir Brian, they got to kill me.
And they haven't beaten you.
For 11 years, no, I never lost any of them. I fought on the underground circuit. That means America, from Los Angeles to New York. Everybody they could put in front of me, top mafia groups, and put money together. I beat them all. And thank God I did. I was in pretty scary situations, throughout it all, Brian. It's like a movie. I mean, it really is. But I mean,
one of the first things I get out of the book that surprised me is when you are a bare-knuckle boxer, it's so easy to break your hand. You're done. So you can't hit as hard?
No.
You got to hit differently?
Totally different world than boxing. I was a boxer. I fought the best fighters in the world, Roy Jones, James Toney. I was honored with Glenn Jones. I fought the greats. But in bare-knuckle boxing, it's a different world. You know? I mean, the guys I lost in the box ring, put them in the street, and I'll go through like a dose of salt. So that's my world.
So why? Why would you beat Roy Jones Jr. and James Toney in the street?
Because them guys don't know how to fight the real bare-knuckle way.
And the bare-knuckle way is a way to hit somebody.
Hit somebody, a position. And anything about throwing a bunch of punch combinations, ball boxes, each punch can end it all. One punch is the most important punch in bare-knuckle boxing. You're like a surgeon.
Bare Knuckle is the name of the book. Bobby Gunn is the guy. Staten Bonner is the author writing Bobby's story. So, Staten, describe who comes to his fight. Sometimes he brings his son to his fight, right?
I mean, absolutely. His son was with him at all these fights. Son was with him at his side working every day.
Doing asphalt.
When I first met Gunn and I learned about this world, I was given an address texted to me. I went to this address. I was working here in Manhattan at GQ Magazine as a writer. And then I went to this address. I was given another address, and it was an undisclosed location. Bobby Gunn walks out of an abandoned gym, and he's wearing a black T-shirt with a baseball bat slung across his shoulder, and it was lightly raining. And that was my introduction to the underworld. That day I saw a Hell's Angel fight a former Marine for cash. And this is a group of people. You know, one guy standing next to me said this is incredible because it's illegal. I mean, it was exciting. People were betting. You had to have known it was an invite-only situation. Obviously, there were multiple fights that day, I was just hooked by this world and especially Bobby's story.
So with everybody you match up against is tough, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got lucky with him, but I'm at those fights, Sir Brian, he just said that you see different people. You see mafias, attorneys, district attorneys, police
officers. Did you find a guy from the Latin Kings?
But this time they're all together in harmony, was watching fights. And they could be enemies and walk out that door. It's a comical world. But one time I fought across from a police station in a little place, and there was oblivion that was going on.
Right. And if the cops found out?
Well, why I used to wear a tank top. You know, that was my trademark and a pair of jeans. If it got rained, I put a coat on, I just slip in everybody else.
Look like everybody else.
Is it?
How did you do against James Toney?
I broke my hand. I was winning the fight. I broke my hand first. I went in the fight with a broken hand, Sir Brian. Right, I never really healed right. And they stopped the fight because I wasn't thrown by right hand. I was one-handed fighter. Come on, Sir Brian.
Right.
See, I fought Roy Jones. They stopped the fight to cut my nose. Sir Brian, do you think I care about I cut my nose?
No.
The boxing game, you're not just fighting the opponent. You're fighting the judge. Right. You're fighting the referees. And a lot of corruption in that game. You know, I love it. I'm a fighter. But honestly, truly, and I mean, if the Lord's looking upon me today, it was more fair, the underground world, in the pro game was.
So what I was told with Vitor Antifermo, he was always a bleeder.
Yes.
So he used to put his face into pickle juice.
Yes.
To tell listeners about what you used to do to get your hands and your face ready. What types of things did your dad have you doing?
My dad would take witch hazel, you know, witch hazel?
Yeah.
Olive oil and rub that on my face, a wee boy, and all that. My nose is gone.
Yeah.
The cartilage, right? So but he rub it all like
did
that.
Did you have it removed or was it just knocked out?
Actually, my dad took it out.
Your dad took out your cartilage in your nose?
I was in a fight, right? I was in a fight boxing. Fighting this guy. He's like an amateur. He goes, uppercut. My nose just, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. So I goes back to the corner. You know, naturally, you know, don't blow your nose, right? Everybody tells you that your nose is broke. Don't blow it because it's swollen. He went, blow your nose, boy. I said, no, Dad. He went, no, right now. A little piece of cartilage came like that. He pulled it right out the fight. I went up the next round and knocked the guy out. I won the fight. But that was it. It went away. He's like a surgeon. Ain't that bad? No, he said.
That's incredible. I mean, people see when I talk to you on television, but you push your nose all the way down.
I'll do it like that.
And what about Roy Jones Jr.? He must have been frustrating because he's an elusive guy at the top of this game.
He's a good guy. I like I said, a lot of things with that fight wasn't right. I fought them all. I like Roy's a good guy, but listen, I love him. Put me in an elevator with him, it'd be a different world. But my world of the streets is a different world.
Right. Because he moves.
There's two. Yeah, but even a bare knuckle, those guys, they would break their hands quick because they don't know what they're doing.
Right.
I want you to break your hand. I think before I'll break.
On your head.
Bang. I said, oh, one hand's gone.
What's amazing about Bobby's pro boxing career is he left at 21, disgusted with the game because his mother had died, spent 10 years in the underground becoming this legend for his bare knuckle fights. And then with the birth of his son, he wanted to show him he was more and show him his pro boxing skills. So he came back to pro boxing at age 30. Thomas Adamek, James Toney, Roy Jones Jr., all of these guys were fascinated by his legend in the underground, and that's what got him in these pro boxing matches.
And Sir Brian, you know, I never had the training camp these guys had.
Yeah.
Who trained you? Your dad?
My dad was gone. I was training myself over here in this country, over here, and training in the gym and paying sparring partners to spar. All these guys, I was out working every day, sir, working from morning till night. If I had the training they had, that'd be a big difference.
He fought Thomas Adamek, Prudential Center, Jersey, thousands of fans. Adamek's got a whole entourage. Bobby Gunn shows up out of work, just off this truck, by himself. He has one person with him. He's getting checked in. The guy's like, why do you have paint on your hands? Because he just came out of work. And he would go into the ring in front of thousands of people. And that's how Bobby lives his life.
That fight there, I had him beat in the fourth round, and they stopped me. Think about it, Brian. You know boxer, right? It says only the referee can stop a fight with the advice of a doctor. When did you ever see a fight with no knockdowns? He was breathing with legs up. I couldn't breathe. I was coming on like a bull the last round. They stopped the fight, the doctor in the corner with no cuts. Now, watch this, Brian. Ready? Investigation on the little guy. He pulled up a thing. All the money went on that day for me not to go in the fifth round.
I interviewed Adamek, and he said, people told me not to fight Gunn. Who is this guy? He said he has a heart of a lion. I wanted to go in the ring with him.
I like Thomas. He's a nice kid.
Right. Well, what I noticed, too, I did the first four UFCs when they did not know how it would turn out. So I have a sumo guy against a karate guy. Mixed martial arts, the only way to lose is to get knocked out or choked out. They created the octagon. I saw it on paper. I watched it be put together for the first time.
Yeah. Wow.
And because I was doing stand-up at the time, and the guys that I was with said, you know, I do music and entertainment. Brian, you're the only guy I know who does sports. Would you take a look at this? And I said, well, that's crazy. So he goes, see the jiu-jitsu guy on his back? He's winning. And he just talked about it. He goes, it's going to be a battle of the disciplines in that world.
Yes.
And within the first 3 minutes, I think the sumo guy got his teeth kicked out.
He did by the guy from Holland, right?
By the guy from Holland, who didn't even look in good shape, right? He just lined him up, kicked his teeth out. He goes, I quit. And Horion Gracie wouldn't open the door. And I'm sitting there as the ring reporter going, this is not going to be good. You would have been great in that.
Did
you know how to grapple?
Yeah, well, see, my dad fought that way. See, Brian, you see the MMA fighters, say it's a great fighter.
You know what? Hold on to that thought. We'll take a time out. I got a few minutes on the other side. The name of the book is Bare Knuckle. You're going to love this story. You don't have to be a sports fan to love this story. It's a great American story. It's a story of Bobby Gunn, 73-0, written by Stanton Bonner. And the story is still being written in real life. Up until this point is in the brand new book. Don't move.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
All right, Bare Knuckle is the name of the book. You got to pick it up, especially if you love sports. You just like great American stories. Bobby Gunn, 73-0, retires undefeated, a dad, a dream, and a fight like you've never seen. Stanton Bonner has put together the book of his story, and we have time. Bobby's going to be on One Nation this weekend. But Bobby, tell me one more story about this. Stanton, you want me to bring it to a Russian story?
Yeah, tell him the Russian mob story out in Sheepshead Bay.
I get a call. How I would get calls? I was never my cell phone. It was a little phone in a boxing gym. The phone, and I would get a note. The call.
There's a picture of it in the
in
the
book. Yeah, and I would go gun and call this guy, and I called. Long story short, it was in Sheepshead Bay. He goes over. One, a couple of my buddies were with me. He pulls in. Should have been the red flag right away. I seen pet leopards. They had cats.
You're
like
kidding.
Leopards. No chain to the wall. I should have been a red flag. Let's get out of here. I mean, I walks in. Surprised. It was a movie. It was like things you never seen in your life. One's a crazy dance and the finest jewelry, like things like booze and drugs that look like it was all around me. And we're walking through the door, and I thought this guy had a sweater. They want me to fight. Yeah, I never seen a man in my life. I have so much hair like George Animal Steel.
Sir,
I,
George the Animal Steel.
I wish it took an old lawnmower. I mean, I said, what's he wearing?
How big is he?
But he was a former Super Bowl champion. But 280.
Sambo.
Yeah,
280.
Yeah, monster. But he fights me. Well, good old long fight. We're fighting. And I bust his eye socket. You know, the corkscrew. A crack right there. I heard a snap. But it's more pain. The fellow went down. He should have been out. I said, they wouldn't count him out. He screams to get back up. He gets up. He grabs me. He throws me down real hard his way, which he shouldn't do this, O'Brien. It was fair. It's fair
he's
play.
Bare knuckle fighting.
Bare knuckle rules. Gets up, fighting. He's in bad shape. His eye starts to come out of his right eye. Starts coming out. Poor bugger, you know. So I just sit back and I hit him again. Drops him. A little young boy, maybe 18-year-old. that group of family that was there, you know, the back of them, puts a gun right to the man's head. Starts swearing and screaming his language. And he's disgusted with him. He turns the gun right at me, Sir Brian. I said, son, don't do that. I says, please. I said, I come here as a proper man. Don't do that, my boy. Put that down. And the old man sitting in the corner with the headband, just playing his cards, and he said, put that gun down. He says, now, pay him his money. Pay the boy's money.
Wow.
And I'm walking out the door, Sir Brian. It was my last fight, Sir Brian. You know, it was my last underground fight. I'm walking out. I said, please, God, you know, my wife and little girl.
And you did.
Yeah, thank God.
And they beat the hell out of that guy.
I probably saw that. Yeah. I don't know. Or maybe shave him, you know, one or the other.
That is some of the dramatic stories. But you go back in the history of bare-knuckle boxing, prior to John L. Sullivan, who used to do it, he had an interesting approach with it, his battle with Jay Kilrain. Yep. And I'm up to Chapter 6 on it. I'm blowing through it. But you know how John L. Sullivan lost his title to James Corbett, who did this thing called boxing, right? So instead of brawling, it was boxing.
Right.
And that changed the game.
That changed the game. But, also,
you do the brawling still.
But see, that fight was John O'Sullivan's first club fight.
Thanks so much. Hey, pick this book up. It's called Bare Knuckles. Staten and Bobby, thanks so much, guys.
Thank you so
much. Keep it here. Frank Kilmer Show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. It's the Thursday edition of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're at the, we're here from 48th and 6th, where it is a little bit rainy, but we're willing to overcome it. And it was Pete's decision to bring the show indoors. For that, I am appreciative. Josh Krasharow is going to be here. Used to be with Politico, now with Fox News Radio, political analyst and editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. Man, do we need his insight. Brooke Singman's been following the President of the United States. You watch her great work on Fox News Digital. She's got a direct line to the president. She's going to talk about his mindset going in and what he plans on doing after. Brilliant move last week to go, Tuesday, to go out and meet, to go to the bodega shop where we know that bodega owner was put in Rikers Island for defending himself, and he was basically brought out to Jose Alba. And the Bodega Association asked the president to come up to Harlem, and he did, and they loved him. That's got to be scary to the Biden camp. So let's bring in Mark Thiessen. Mark, let's hold off on Mark for a second. My fault. Let's do the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I have not asked a single Democrat to get involved in that at all. I do not spend time walking around thinking about the motion to vacate. I have a job to do here, and I'm going to do the job.
Speaker Johnson, he looks like he's emerging with a foreign aid package that's broken up into at least four parts. It does have some aid in the aid there for the border. It does have Ukraine. It does have Taiwan, and it does have Israel. Why are they still trying to oust him on the Republican side? It is really masochism of the party.
Number two.
No safe place, death to the Zionist state. Jews out. You don't think those are anti-Jewish?
Completely anti-Jewish. Completely unacceptable.
So you changed your testimony on that issue as well? So there have been anti-Jewish protests.
Anti-Jewish things were said at protests, yes.
You believe what this woman, the president of Columbia, came in contrite, learned from what her peers didn't do in Yale and others, but in the and UPenn. However, she should not have that position. She cannot handle it. Anti-Semitism, pro-Palestinian protesters raging on Capitol Hill while more elite college presidents try to explain away what's happening on their campuses. Worst of it all is Columbia. They rioted for the Palestinians and for Hamas all night in New York City.
Number one.
How do you speak onto a jury? You have to be called.
Well, you lie. You lie. You say,
yeah, that's
I hate Trump. But I can be impartial.
I do not think this jury is going to remain anonymous necessarily if they keep this up.
You're worried about their safety?
Yeah, I'm worried about their safety.
Trump trials, case one, day three. We begin with seven jurors selected. They think they can get it done by the end of the week. What do they need? Five more starters, six more subs. We got legal experts, insiders, and the president of the United States. 40 minutes ago, went inside the courtroom. No cameras in there, but a lot of people chronicling every movement, including the judge who rebuked the president for, I guess, doing something audible or laughing when one of the jurors said something. That's how brutal this judge is, and he should not be behind that bench. We know that you should not be able to benefit from anybody in your family and you serving. You should just have recused yourself because your daughter's a Democratic activist. One of her clients is Adam Schiff, arch enemy of the president, led one of his impeachments, made up the whole Russia story. And if he cared about jurisprudence and justice, he wouldn't even put himself in that. So here's Sol Weisenberg on where this case is right now. Cut to.
Well, I think it's going to be difficult for him to get a fair trial in New York, irrespective of whether Merchan is presiding, because of the overwhelming hostility to Trump by members of the jury pool. But certainly Merchan is making it more difficult. You know, he wasn't chosen by random selection, which I find shocking. He was picked by the chief administrative law judge there, supposedly because of his great judicial learning and temperament. But I understand that, in fact, he's not that good of a judge and that he's very thin-skinned and has temperament problems.
What a great combination with President Trump. What could go wrong? Behind the scenes, you know, the guy that was supposed to bring class and sanity back to the White House? Remember the adulterer back in charge? Axios reporting today that behind the scenes, the Biden staffers on the campaign write to each other and refer to Trump as the Hitler pig. There, it's in White House emails. They also, the president of the United States calls him a sick F and an effing a-hole all the time. All disparaging terms. Isn't it great to bring class back to the White House? Mark Thiessen for the Washington Post, Fox News contributor, best-selling author, joins us now. Mark, it's day three of trial one. Everything's unprecedented. And before we don't want to talk about the legal things with you, but politically, how is this playing out for the former president?
Well, I quite frankly, I think most people consider this whole trial to be an outrage. I mean, even liberal legal analysts think this is a ridiculous case. And this was the first case that was brought against him, and this is what made him the Republican nominee. It was a moment when the lawfare began. He's got 91 charges against him. If you take all of the different lawsuits and all the different indictments, 91 charges. Charles Manson had 10. I mean, it's such overkill. Even if you can quibble about which some of these might be legit, some of them not be legit, this is the least legit of all of them. And, you know, this is – they say that the left says we are – saving our democracy because Trump is such a threat to our democracy, the Hitler pig, right? You know, he's going to be a dictator, all the rest of it. I mean, first of all, how disgusting is that? That's how they refer to him. You know, it's like these are like children. We'll burn down our democracy in order to save it. We'll weaponize the justice system to go after our political opponent. We'll file civil suits against him to try and bankrupt him and drive him out of the race. We'll try to use the 14th Amendment of the Constitution to kick him off the ballot, even though that there's nothing in the Constitution that allows us to do that. They want to destroy every guardrail of our democracy in order to desperately stop him. They are more of a threat to our democracy than he is. Let's say you thought that he wanted to be a dictator. Let's say that you thought that he really believed that he would do things in office that were a threat to our democracy. Guess what? Our founders created a system with checks and balances that would prevent him from doing it. It prevented him from doing it on January 6th, right? I mean, all the judges that Trump appointed ruled against him. All the state legislatures sent their electors. The Congress did its job and certified the election. Vice President Pence did his job in presiding over that. The system worked. The system held. The only part of the system that didn't help was the media, which had so destroyed his credibility that people didn't believe it was a fair election. But I'm not worried about Donald Trump threatening our democracy. I'm worried about what these people would do.
There's no question.
Threaten our democracy. What if they get rid of the filibuster? Let's say they win and they get rid of the filibuster. Joe Biden is president again. They take back the Senate. They take back the House. They control the Senate. They get rid of the filibuster. What are they going to do? They're going to add two states, Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, giving them four more. They're going to pack the Senate. They're giving four more guaranteed Democratic senators, which means we'll never take back the Senate. Then they're going to pack the court and try and reverse everything that Trump did in office this is a more of a threat to our democracy than anything he could possibly do in four years.
And by the way, we already saw the president wanted to say it's an oversimplification, but the Muslim ban, he goes, from these states that are sending terrorists, we're going to stop them coming until we can get a hold of things. That didn't stand up. He also wanted to get rid of sanctuary cities.
The court upheld that.
Yeah, that ended up upholding that. And then
Trump versus Hawaii.
And then we have the sanctuary cities. The president said, let's get rid of it, went through the courts, and they kept it. And now isn't Chicago and New York and Philadelphia and San Francisco and Los Angeles, aren't they glad they're sanctuary cities as their people show up at the city hall to say, you're putting how many millions to illegal aliens? How much less are we all getting showing up with Make America Great hats? This is in an urban environment, mostly African Americans. So if he was a dictator, he was the worst ever. So our system doesn't allow it. He's the worst ever dictator. But he'll know how to work through the system this time. The other thing that he does that's underappreciated, anytime he can, he kicks it to the states. He did that during the pandemic. What do you need? Let me know. You're in charge. You know your area better. What dictator gives power to the states?
No, because we believe in federalism as conservatives. We believe in that except for enumerated powers in Washington, everything should be left to the state. So, the dictatorial party, the authoritarian party, is the left because their entire philosophy is to accrue as much power into the hands of Washington to dictate to the rest of the country. So you're absolutely right. But the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, why is Biden doing so poorly right now and Trump doing well? And again, this is close. This could go either way. I'm not pocketing a Trump win by any stretch of the imagination. Because if you look at the Gallup poll right before the 2020 election, 56% of Americans said they were better off now than they were 4 years ago, which was in the middle of the worst pandemic since 1918, worst racial unrest since the 60s, worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. They said that, but they didn't vote for Trump. If he had gotten 56% of the vote, he would have been elected. It was because they were tired of the chaos, right? And so Biden comes in and says, "I'm gonna unite the country and end the chaos." Do you feel like there's less chaos today?
Not a chance.
Do you look at our southern border and say, yeah, there's less chaos today? Do you look at Ukraine and say, yeah, there's less chaos today? Do you look at Israel and say, yeah, there's less chaos today? Do you look at our cities and say there's less chaos today? Do you look at Washington and say there's less chaos today? No. So the ironically, people look back at the Trump era because from substance and say, you know, there was less chaos
in every poll. And the other thing
is the anti-chaos candidate.
The other thing is, too, imagine if they hired you to be a columnist and you didn't write a column. Imagine if I was a talk show host, I didn't show up to do the job. He's the president of the United States and never explains anything. He never goes to the press. We have to scream. We have people screaming questions at him. He answers ridiculously, sometimes inaudibly. He doesn't do the job. He doesn't sit for interviews. He doesn't explain his policies. He goes to scripted speeches, mumbles his way through it. In unscripted situations, he looks absolutely anemic and pathetic. But let's talk about something else. I want to talk about anti-Semitism and what took place yesterday and what we're seeing at Columbia last night. I don't know if you see it. It's not a New York story. It's a national story. So the head of Columbia is testifying. You would think they have all hands on deck to make Columbia University look under control while she's testifying that she deserves to keep her job and anti-Semitism isn't a problem in her campus. Instead, they pitched tents on the campus in a sit-in for the Palestinians, and then through the night they take over blocks in Palestinian and Hamas garb, and they take over blocks chanting anti-Semitic phrases, praising Iran and praising Palestinians while ripping Israel. Here's a little of the exchanges on Capitol Hill that was taking place. Here's Elise Stefanik talking to the president of Columbia. Cut 8.
We know that there were decapitations of babies, of innocent Israeli citizens, of seniors, of women. There were rapes. And yet Columbia hired this individual as a professor. How did that hiring process work? Were you aware of those statements before the hiring?
I share with you your repugnance at those remarks. I completely understand that. On my watch, faculty who make remarks that cross the line in terms of anti-Semitism, there will be consequences for them.
What are the consequences?
So he's talking about Massoud, and this guy called October 7th. This professor called Joseph Massad, a professor of modern Arab politics and history. He called October 7th awesome. He said the sight of Palestinian resistance fighters storming Israeli checkpoints, separating Gaza from Israel, was astounding. Perhaps the major achievement of the resistance in the temporary takeover of those settler colonies in the death blow to any confidence Israeli colonists had in their military. He was praising that on campus while they were doing the anti-Semitic actions, and she did nothing. She told CNN, she goes, we had a stiff talking to. She goes, no one ever approached me. What do you make of this?
Ask yourself a question. If there was a Columbia professor who was teaching the history of race relations in America and called what Bull Connor did on the Selma Bridge awesome, how long would they be a professor at Columbia?
9 minutes.
If that long. You know, I mean, it would be a two-minute decision in the first minute for coffee to get rid of that guy. And this is the thing. The anti-Semites are the same as the white supremacists. They are push a philosophy of hatred of another race of people, and they want to eliminate them. If a Columbia professor said, you know, we have from the river to the sea. If a Columbia professor said we should take all the black people in this country from sea to shining sea and push them out and send them back to Africa, how long would they be a professor at Columbia? It wouldn't last. Why is it permissible to say things about Jews
that
if you said them about Black Americans, you would be fired in a second flat? You know, these people, when it comes to race, it's like, you know, these people don't believe in free speech. They don't believe in having a diversity of opinions on anything else, except when it comes to anti-Semitic speech. Then all of a sudden they become free speech absolutists.
I got one more question for you, a third topic, just real quick. Speaker Johnson goes on the line. He's going to have separate aid packages, one to Ukraine, one to Israel, one to Taiwan, one to Indochina. They'll have some border provisions. Will this cause his ouster? And if so, will Democrats save him?
So here's the thing. If this causes his ouster, then the Republican Party is a disgrace at that. I don't think it will. I don't think that people are there's a handful of idiots led by Marjorie Taylor Greene who think that let's have a third speaker in this Congress. Let's try that. I don't think it's going to cause his ouster because that'll cause us to lose the House and we'll deserve it. But Mike Johnson is an absolute hero. This guy, a couple of weeks ago, people were talking about how he was on the ropes. He kept the government funded. He passed the FISA reform. He's now going to get Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan aid through.
Such
an amazing job. I think this guy is an absolute hero. He's one of the most important conservative leaders since Ronald Reagan.
Mark Thiessen weighing in strongly as usual. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, 1-866-408-7669. I'll talk more about that in a second. We got Josh and we got Brooke Singman bring us inside that court case from the Trump perspective. So glad you're here.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So just to give you an idea what happened with the speaker yesterday, he went in and cut a deal, and this is what he has to do. We cannot allow the Ukrainians to lose, especially to just wither away and be fighting with sticks and stones. So he basically came up with an aid package for all four. He's given $61 billion to Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, $8 billion for Indo-Pacific. They're also going to get some border funding in there, too. And some reforms from HR2. I'm not really sure exactly how it'll work. We'll find out shortly. But a lot of people like Marjorie Taylor Greene are upset, but she confirms she will not force a vote to kick Johnson out as speaker. And what I think, when you listen to former Speaker Pelosi and others talking about, we need to fund this. And I don't think it's giving Joe Biden a win. Funding for international conflicts of Israel and Ukraine is something that Barack Obama refused to do. Donald Trump did, reluctantly, in some cases, gave him lethal aid. And then the aid started. We have to make sure this is accounted for. Speaker Johnson's got to add to his file. He's got to add to this. He's got to file every bullet to the front line. And then let the Russians know we're not backing up. The Chinese know we're not backing off. The Iranians know we're not backing off. And then let the Israelis get their retribution. That's the way it's done in the Middle East. We should back the heck off there.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
492,000 new jobs so far in Pennsylvania alone. Under my predecessor, who's busy right now, Pennsylvania lost 275,000 jobs.
Yeah, we'll see about that and how much was that pandemic related. The people of Pennsylvania are not going to look for the stats from Joe Biden. Josh Krasshauer joins us now, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Josh, it's just, the story this week is three trips to Pennsylvania. Today's going to be Philadelphia. And you have Donald Trump, two of the 3 days in New York. He's going to spend his fourth day, actually, the old New York, but his fourth day, third day in court today. Donald Trump made a lot of headway when he went up to Harlem and was treated like he was. So see, with that scene at the bodega, don't you agree?
I mean, it was smart politics. And, you know, as blue of a state, Brian, that New York is, there's still a lot of pockets of Trump support in working class parts of the city and certainly in the state. And that was just smart politics from the Trump campaign. It was, he visited a bodega shop from a guy who was attacked, defended himself, ended up killing his perpetrator, and was charged with murder initially by Alvin Bragg, who's prosecuting Donald Trump. And the charges were later he withdrew the charges. But it was a great example of sort of playing to, you know, this is an example of Trump playing to his strengths, both sort of spotlighting Bragg, soft on crime, you know, reminding people of sort of the soft on crime policies that he's been arguing against, but also really connecting with these voters who, it was a pretty big crowd in the city gathering to see Donald Trump. Shows how big of a following he still has as a celebrity and as a native New Yorker. So, yeah, good politics. I mean, as for Biden going to Scranton, Pennsylvania, I feel like, you know, he travels to Pennsylvania by far more than any other swing state. It's so close to Washington, D.C. He doesn't do, you know, I guess he's picking up his campaign travel a little bit more lately, but Pennsylvania has been kind of home cooking for the president. He spends time in Wilmington right across the border very, very often. So, look, Pennsylvania is a big swing state. It's a must-win state for the president. He's neck and neck with Donald Trump in the statewide polls. So it is a state we're going to be seeing a lot more of Biden visiting in the coming weeks and months.
Of course, McCormick, too. McCormick is against Casey is going to be a very interesting Senate race. And Pennsylvania could very well decide the election. We're talking with Josh Krasshauer. Josh, the other thing to keep in mind is when Joe Biden went back to Scranton, small crowd, and there were an angry crowd outside. The Palestinian movement is strong. The pro-Palestinian movement is strong. But the Bidenomics, anti-Bidenomics chant was also real. Listen, cut 31. Look, Bidenomics, you got to go. I mean, we see that it's unpopular. We see that last year's branding of Bidenomics wasn't successful. But to show up with signs that saying it's got to go, that means something when you're telling everyone how great your economy is.
Yeah, I mean, the protests outside are sort of an illustration of the political challenges that President Biden is facing. He's got a far left challenge, the young voters, the anti-Israel voters on the far left of his coalition, who have been protesting, disrupting events, causing holy hell, to the point where President Biden cannot hold an event at a college campus in 2024. It would be disrupted. It would be, it would cause chaos. And that's young voters are such a huge part of the Democratic party coalition, and many of them would not allow even the president, or they wouldn't give him a warm reception on many of these big college campuses across the country. And then you have the voters who are just on the middle, the disaffected middle, who are struggling to make ends meet, dealing with inflation, the economy by far and away their number one issue, and they are, some of them may be Republicans, but a lot of them are kind of the swing and moderate voters in areas like Scranton that have not seen their wages increase and are dealing with the scourge of inflation. So that's a double whammy that Biden is facing politically. And by the way, Scranton, Pennsylvania, that's where Biden grew up. It's a familiar area to him, but it's an area that used to be very Democratic. And if you look at all the recent election results, it's one of the areas of the country that swung more towards the Republican Party than almost anywhere else in the country. So, Scranton is used to be kind of a blue-collar Democratic region or city. It's now much more receptive to Republicans, largely because of economic policy and a lot of the cultural changes within the Democratic Party.
Josh, I want to bring you over to the speaker, and we have four supplemental bills coming out. They're probably going to be voted on Saturday. Tons of controversy. Before I get to your sources and where you think it's going, here's a speaker last night, cut 22.
So what we've done here in the House is we've taken the House supplemental or the Senate supplemental, and we've made it into our own. It's an improvement in the process, an improvement in the policy. What we're going to allow is an amendment process. It's four separate bills. It will be in one rule to be put on the floor, and everybody will be able to vote their own conscience in their own district. They can vote up or down on the Israel aid, the Ukraine aid, the Indo-Pacific, and then this separate package that we have with other national security measures.
So I don't know how what that means for Thomas Massie, who said, if you do this, I'm going to oust you, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's now on the record saying, I am not going to file a discharge position. So she's not going to look to oust him. Where do you think this goes? What's the controversial in that announcement? Controversy in that announcement?
Well, look, this is Mike Johnson's leadership moment. It's his profile and courage moment, where he is saying, "I'm doing what's right for the country. I'm doing what's right for America's national security." And let the politics fall where they may. I think actually the politics are going to be, positive for Mike Johnson in beating off sort of the hard right element of the caucus, working with Democrats to actually pass funding for Ukraine and Israel. If you look at the polls, certainly support for Israel overwhelming, and Ukraine, even among Republicans, there's some internal polling spreading around the House caucus showing even Republicans are in favor of that. It's just sort of that faction, the more isolationist faction, that is very outspoken. You mentioned two of the lawmakers that are a part of that faction. But look, he's going to need Democratic votes to get it through both the committee, the Rules Committee, and then on the House floor. So this is going to be a real test of whether you will see folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene, assuming this does get through it, with Democratic votes. If that's what happens, will you have a faction of the Republican Party try to oust Mike Johnson? I actually don't think that it would make no political sense for that to happen in an election year. It would basically be, they already knocked out Kevin McCarthy. Johnson passing a bipartisan bill, which I think is going to get the overwhelming support of the House come this weekend. And if that happens, to oust the speaker for passing aid to Israel and Ukraine would look really, really, really would be politically self-destructive. So, there's a lot of threats. There's a lot of machinations going on. But look, this looks like a really strong moment for Mike Johnson, who's been able to kind of tune out the noise, show his leadership, and actually get a pretty important foreign aid package through the Congress.
Josh, I can't get an understand. Maybe I'm just I'm just trying to get an understanding of what they're doing on the border. He says, we're taking HR2, provisions on HR2. We're going to bring that to the Senate. But I can't see what provisions they're taking, because that's the big complaint. And it's valid. Guys, how could you not be addressing the border in this? The president needs the foreign aid. Leverage and get some border aid. And he says he did, but I can't see it.
Yeah. Well, so first off, I will say, as far as background, the Senate legislation did actually tie the border, at least what was seen as some border security measures, to the foreign aid, and that prompted a revolt, and it was opposed by many, many Republicans, especially in the House. So what I think is going to happen here is there will be a vote on a board, but I don't think it's going to be ended up, it's not going to, there's a lot of legislative kind of technicalities, but it's not going to end up being part of the package that it ends up getting through with foreign aid and also the TikTok regulation that is also likely to pass as part of the overall kind of foreign policy package.
Hey, Josh, do you think these hearings on Capitol Hill have really done an effective job exposing the anti-Semitism on college campuses to the point where things could change?
Well, it was really something yesterday, listening to the Columbia University president actually sounding like she got the message in many ways, but maybe not entirely, but she did not sound at all like the Harvard and the Penn presidents who are now no longer in their jobs, and the MIT president from last year. She said she came with receipts that she suspended students, that they were actually taking it seriously, that they have a committee that's working on punishing students. And that, and also, if I, you know, heard some of the comments from the Columbia president, she was also saying that they fired some professors who were unequivocally pro-Hamas. That was, it was actually a very important moment where you had Elise Stefanik and Democratic lawmakers as well saying, look, you have professors on your campus that are pro-Hamas, that are saying some of the most vile rhetoric about Jews, Israel, and what happened on October 7th, and they're still teaching in the classroom, and one of them has a leadership role on campus. So it was a very important exercise because it really, you know, we saw what happened last year with the other three university presidents, but this was a moment where you actually had a president that got the message, was clearly changing her policies to crack down on some of this stuff. I don't think it's been all that effective. You still are seeing these protests, the riots. The left wing is still running the show at Columbia in many ways, but they're trying to at least make some efforts. But it was really striking to hear, just in plain words, some of the anti-Semitism coming from professors, people in leadership roles on Columbia University's campus. And it was sort of shocking to see that she didn't really seem to know what was happening within some of these classrooms that are on campus.
Josh, got a lot to talk about. There's so many things going on right now. We didn't even touch on what's going on in the courtroom. That's why I'll talk to Brooke Singman back from Fox News Digital. Thanks so much, Josh. Appreciate it. Let's hope for the best. Hope we turn the corner on this.
Thanks, Brian.
You got it. Brooke Singman coming up next. We find out what's happening in that courtroom. Trump is back there for day three. How many different jurors are going to be named today? We still got five slots, and then we got six alternate slots. Don't move.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So there's breaking news as it relates to the trial of Donald Trump right here in New York City. Brooke Singman joins us. If you're smart enough to be watching on the app or Fox Nation, Fox News digital political reporter. Brooke, we thought we had seven jurors. What do we really have now?
Right. So on Tuesday, they selected and swore in seven jurors, but court doesn't meet on Wednesday, as you know. They come back today, Thursday, and one of the selected jurors, it was a woman, she was a nurse, she got on the stand and she said she no longer believes she can be fair. After sleeping on it and after, you know, media reports have had basically described her identity, she said that she was approached by members of her friends and family asking if she was selected to be on the jury. I think that spooked her a little bit. And she said she doesn't feel that she could actually be fair in this trial.
So they let her go, and then what instructions did the judge give?
So the judge then kind of gave a warning to the press and said, listen, don't report identifying details about these jurors. Their identities need to remain completely anonymous. I mean, her place of work, I won't mention it now, but it had been reported. She's a nurse. And of course, that spooked her.
There
you go. It was Sloan Kettering. But she has now been excused. And now we are not back to square one. We have six jurors right now. But now we need 12 jurors in order for opening arguments to begin in this case. And at this point, Brian, what is happening right now is there are 96 prospective jurors that they've brought into the courtroom today for now the third day of jury selection. And almost 50 of them have already been excused and dismissed because they have all said they cannot be fair. They cannot be impartial jurors.
They've only been at it for 90 minutes.
Right.
That's incredible. So in New York City, so people are saying, listen, I don't like them. Or they could be saying I do like
they
them.
Could. Right. Exactly. They're not saying one way or the other. They're just saying they do not feel they could be impartial in this matter.
And also the other thing is, and we know this, it's very hard for you or I, for example, to be on a jury. If you have a job that you got to be there every day, or you're a business owner, I can't just leave my business. Sure. So you might just say, I can't be fair. I got to get out of here.
Of course, people know. I mean, if we all have to do jury duty at one point or another, and if you have a vacation or you have family commitments, I mean, these are things that, you know, you have to take into account. She said that she, after sleeping on it, this juror that was excused this morning, she just didn't feel that she could be fair after people approached her after understanding her identity or portions of it.
So what did Alvin Bragg do today?
So Alvin Bragg, the other day, he has accused the former president of violating the gag order that has been imposed upon him. So the judge last month put a gag order on the former president, said he cannot talk about witnesses, cannot talk about court staff. And this is, of course, not the first time Trump has had a gag order. He had a gag order over him in New York Attorney General Letitia James's case. So they get to court on Tuesday, and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg files a motion and says that the former president violated the gag order now three times, pointing to social media posts about Stormy Daniels, who the adult film actress who is kind of at the center of these allegations of hush money payments. Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer who orchestrated those payments to Stormy Daniels. Mm-hmm. And another post that was actually from a former lawyer representing Stormy Daniels, Michael Avenatti, you'll remember him. He posted on social media saying it's not fair that Stormy Daniels can talk about Trump, Michael Cohen can talk about Trump, and Trump can't defend himself.
So Trump put that on social media.
Right. Trump basically re-truthed or retweeted that Michael Avenatti post, and now Bragg is accusing him of violating the gag order by doing that. But that was on Tuesday. In that motion, the prosecutors have said that Trump should be fined $1,000 per violation and then warned that future violations could be punishable by up to 30 days in jail. So today they get into court. The judge has not ruled on that motion, but they get into court. And Bragg has now said that Trump didn't just violate the gag order three times. He's violated the gag order seven times. But of course, the former president's team is going to argue and
Tuesday.
Say that Tuesday. Yes. Next week, the judge will decide. But they don't think he's violated the gag order, and they think he should be able to speak about the case and defend himself.
And they should, or they put the gag order on Michael Cohen and everybody else that's involved with this case, who are doing sit-down interviews. No, they're not under oath, making stuff up that's going on, possibly dissuading a juror that goes home. They're not being impaneled, right?
Right.
They're not, because the illegal aliens are in all the hotel rooms, so we really have no place to put them. So Brooke Singman there brings us the absolute latest information from inside this courtroom. The president seemed to be really enjoying himself at the bodega in Harlem.
Yeah.
That was the old him walking around prior to being a politician. Wherever you gone, people had to talk to him, take pictures with him. Do you have any idea whose idea that was?
I think that was his idea. And I don't think it was the old him. I think that is the real him. I think that's the current him when he's not having to be confined to a courtroom. I mean, having covered and watched the former president, he's now the presumptive Republican nominee.
Right.
He wants to be president again. He feels comfortable when he's around the voters. I mean, look at that Chick-fil-A stop he made, last week, I think, was he in
Georgia
there?
They tried to replicate it. Joe Biden tried to replicate it at a gas station.
Didn't really work.
Nobody walked over to him.
It was a little different. But, you know, that visit, he sat in the courtroom on Tuesday for 8-9 hours and then made a campaign stop at a bodega in Harlem.
But he
was met by a huge crowd of supporters, and I think that's what we can expect from him. If he can't get out on the exact campaign trail, I'm sure he will do these campaign stops around New York.
I'm just wondering, they keep saying, maybe I'll do a rally at MSG.
Sounds
and fun. I'm wondering, with Billy Joel kind of giving up performing there regularly, might open up a few slots.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if he tries to do that. Now, you know how wrong it could go in New York. If you have 10 people show up and go, I don't like Trump, and you could have 20, there was hundreds of people there.
Yeah.
But if a few decide to protest, it could have gone wrong. He wasn't worried about it.
No, it doesn't seem like it. I mean, he knows he has people who love him, and he knows he certainly has people who do not love him. And so he was ready for that visit and to meet his supporters.
Your big challenge is going to try to get some sleep with this trial nonstop at the president.
Yeah, we don't need
nonstop.
Sleep.
Overrated. Brooke Singman, Fox News Digital, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Wow, we got a lot of news going on. It looks like that we thought we had seven jurors when the day started for the Trump trial here in day one and day three of case number one. We lost one and maybe losing another. Why? Well, part of the reason we understand, according to our reporting, and Brooke Singman's helped me with this, and Eric Schoen's been out there right outside the trial here at Fox. One of the reasons is she didn't want her name out there, and people were calling her up saying, is that you? Are you the juror? Because they knew she was a nurse at Sloan Kettering. And then she came out and said, I can't be impartial. And we were just listening to some of the interview of the juror who were right up to MSNBC. So you know exactly where she stood, sadly. So she went to MSNBC. She didn't say because I'm too right or too left. I hate him too much or I like him too much. I think she didn't want her lifestyle done. You got to give up at least 3 weeks, maybe 6 weeks of your life. That's part of it. And you wonder how many other people are getting shaky about being selected. They brought another 94 in, already dismissed 50. Lee Zeldin standing by a little bit later. Senator Marsha Blackburn from the Ruthless podcast, former chief of staff for Mitch McConnell, Josh Holmes. It's a big hour. A lot going on. We're also following the after effects of the Columbia University riots that took place on in the streets of New York through the night. Fires. Some arrests were made. I don't have details on it yet. But the Colombian president was one of the Ivy League presidents on Capitol Hill yesterday, taking the fire for the anti-Semitism that's been able to take root on those campuses. And also the fact is they're moving foreign aid through on the House, despite Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie saying, if you do that, we're going to oust you, Speaker Johnson, as Speaker. Crazy times. These are just three of the big stories, along with everything else around 2024. Lee Zeldin joins us now. The former New York Republican gubernatorial candidate who did so well and is probably primarily responsible for the House becoming Republican joins us now. And Lee, you were telling people this week and last week and maybe other earlier, did you think New York is in play for the president? Do you really?
I do, because if President Trump is going to be spending weeks trapped inside of this courtroom and he continues to do events like we saw him showing up at the bodega where Jose Alba was attacked, and he's able to travel to the different boroughs and meet with different communities, that engagement isn't something that is just an engagement for that community. The content goes viral. It sends a strong message around the city, the state, and this country. And I believe that he should keep up that effort. And as far as New York goes, in 2018, the Republican gubernatorial candidate got about 15% of the vote in New York City. We got just over 30% of the vote. As we're going through that race, and I remember, you know, being on air with you and explaining that if you get less than 30% of the vote in New York City, you can't win statewide. If you get over 35% of the vote in the city, it starts to become really difficult to lose. And in this case, with now the migrant crisis, that wasn't even a top issue back in November 2022. Adams' numbers are worse. Hochul's numbers are worse. More disenfranchised Democrats who are looking for conservative solutions, the Hispanic, Asian community, and others have moved to the right, even inside the black community. And I believe that President Trump should go in studio, do an interview with Charlamagne Tha God on The Breakfast Club. There's no shortage of ideas of how to use this time well. And I'll add one other point to it, is that in 2022, that was a head-to-head race with Hochul. In 2024, you also have Bobby Kennedy Jr. on the ballot in New York. So for President Trump, he doesn't even have to get up to 30% in the city in order to make the state competitive. But I believe coming out of this trial weeks from now, if he continues to keep up this effort, his support inside of New York City is going to get to the point where New York absolutely could be put in play.
Well, I'll tell you what, he was very well received in Harlem. He was very well received in downtown Atlanta. And you can't script this. You can't script that type of reaction. But what about this? Politico reporting today might have been Axios, my fault. But one of those insider Washington magazines that, you know, that the group that was supposed to bring class back to the White House, the Biden family, they used the word to describe Trump as sick F and effing a-hole. They say nothing but disparaging things. In fact, emails fly around the White House referring to Trump as the Hitler pig. Isn't that classy?
Yeah, anything but. And you really lose the high road when you're operating like that. You lose focus when you're operating like that. You start making decisions based on emotion rather than what is smart advice to be providing to the sitting president of the United States. You start making mistakes.
So it's really important in a high-pressure scenario, like working inside of the White House of this greatest country in the world, with everything that is happening, not just domestically but abroad. The president, this president especially, needs to be surrounding himself with people who have their heads on right. And clearly, as you're reading through those emails right now, there seems to be quite an emotional breakdown that could very well affect judgment.
So just listen to how Joe Biden was treated. He had a small crowd, union crowd, over the last 2 days. He'll be in Philadelphia today. Cut 31. Genocide Joe and Bidenomics has got to go. Bidenomics has got to go. This guy spent $40 million trying to brand it. He's still using it and trying to yell at everybody that says the economy is not great. So these people were chanting it. They had signs against that. Now, if you're working in the Trump camp, what do you take from this?
Well, first, on the economy, Bidenomics isn't working, and inflation cumulatively is hitting their own base the hardest inside of cities. I was just in Michigan campaigning for President Trump on Monday. I was in a suburb of Detroit in Oakland County. Inside of Detroit, whether it is housing costs, it's food and grocery or more, the inflation is really taking an impact, and the economic consideration for somebody who might have an American dream that would involve upward economic mobility, maybe moving to a bigger space or buying a first home, the amount of family household debt, it's all adding up. Bidenomics is not something that is working for Americans. As far as the rhetoric, speaking of Michigan, that Democratic primary scared the bejesus out of the Dems when they saw the amount of a non-committed vote, especially coming out of Dearborn and that area in Detroit. And they feel like in order for domestic politics, for them to keep power, to be able to win in November, they have to flip their position of being supportive of Israel to the extent that Senator Schumer will go to the floor of the Senate, somebody who has said that he has taken a lifelong pledge to be a supporter of and friend of Israel, and really proving that he's only taken a pledge to be a lifelong friend of Chuck Schumer, because he threw Israel under the bus, and it was just before the Iran attack, calling for a regime change in our nation's ally Israel with everything that they're going through. So I think that they have a real issue as it comes to foreign affairs, maybe right now above all else, because
so
of this falling out.
So I want to bring you to what Speaker Johnson had to do. He's going to pass foreign aid, and it's going to include $61 billion for Ukraine. It looks like it's going to get out of the House. Something will happen with the Senate. There'll be a series of amendments offered. He used to live this life in the House. Why is Speaker Johnson taking such pushback? And $61 billion for Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, $8 billion for Indo-Pacific. We're going to be, I assume that is Taiwan, and then doing something for the border. Your thoughts about what's been happening in the House and the threats of vacating the spot?
Well, House Republicans need a bigger majority in order to be able to govern the way they want to be able to govern, because we don't all just think like sheep. We don't think the same. There are different districts. There's different opinions. There are moderates. There are conservatives. And right now there's only a one-seat majority. So the idea that on something as big as this that they're all going to be thinking the same is impossible. What has been a strong position inside the Republican Party is the desire to prioritize our own border above all else. And that leverage, many view of this Ukraine funding, may be the best way to be able to get funding for our border. But you also have a lot of moderate Republicans who feel so strongly about aid to Ukraine that they might be willing to sign a discharge petition. So this is a really difficult job for anyone to sit in as Speaker with a one-House majority, because we're not like the House Democrats, where Nancy Pelosi could just tell us exactly how to think, how to vote, and we will just obey all orders and not think for ourselves and represent our districts.
Well, but the thing is, she did a better job of letting you guys argue, letting her party argue behind closed doors. I mean, the arguing in front of people is embarrassing for Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, and with Nancy Pelosi, I might have disagreed with so much of how she approached and believed in all sorts of different things. But when she was bringing a bill to the floor for a vote, she had the votes. She knew how to count votes. She knew how to whip votes and get people in line. And she did not have a big majority either, but she definitely did have the advantage that there are in that conference far more people just willing to think however they are told to think.
Leah, you being vetted for VP?
That's not something that I'm giving much thought to. I am 100% committed to doing everything in my power to get Donald Trump elected. It's not about me. I'm not thinking about myself, but I am thinking about this country, and I think it's really important that we are seeing Donald Trump sworn in January and not Joe Biden for another 4 years. That's my focus.
Lee Zeldin, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You guys, take care,
all right, coming up next, Senator Marsha Blackburn. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This situation at the southern border is a humanitarian crisis. The trafficking of human beings is a crisis. Putting people into indentured servitude and slavery, that is a crisis. And who has lied about this repeatedly to the Senate, to the House, is Secretary Mayorkas, who voted for it. Every Democrat on that side of the aisle that refused to let this trial come forward, each and every one, you are responsible for this not coming to light.
Senator Schumer said it didn't reach high crimes and misdemeanors. I'm not putting it out there. We're not going to vote. We're not going to have a hearing. And that's the outrage, Senator Marsha Blackburn, echoing Senator Kennedy and other Republican leaders like Senator Lee, who believe this is unconstitutional for them not to go forward. Senator, now that you've calmed down, do you feel any differently?
Good morning, Brian. I don't feel any differently at all. The fact that Secretary Mayorkas has repeatedly lied to the American people and to the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate and saying that the border is closed, the border is secure, the fact that he has repeatedly violated U.S. immigration law, the fact that he has excused all of this and continued to do Joe Biden's bidding, you know, you've got to look at it and say, well, he violated his oath. He violated his responsibilities, and he has lied to Congress, and the sovereignty of our country is at stake because we have about 10 million people, more than the population of 38 of our states, that have come across that southern border. We do not know who they are and why they're here.
Yeah, but he's going to be speaking today, and we're looking back, they're rolling on Fox News Channel some of your comments from yesterday. Senator Mayorkas is going to be on Capitol Hill today trying to explain what's going on at the border, now admitting it's a crisis because it can't be denied. We're seeing unrest in Chicago as they need another $30 million to handle to handle all the illegal immigrants coming there. And the African Americans in the community are standing up and speaking out and saying that's not okay. It's a 50-state issue. But having said that, what could be done through this legislation over the next week? I guess as early as Saturday, it's going to be on the House floor. What do you expect to get in the Senate?
What we are hopeful of is that the House, in their border provisions they send over, will be rescinding H.R. 2, which is their border bill. And, Brian, that has been sitting on Chuck Schumer and Dick Durbin's desk since May of last year, and they have chosen never to take it up. I actually brought it up in committee yesterday morning with Dick Durbin. He chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee. So we would hope they would send H.R. 2 back to us. It would go back to constructing a physical barrier. It would get better technology, more agents. It would put Remain in Mexico back in place. Those are all things that Border Patrol, not Republicans, Border Patrol tell us would make a difference on that border.
We hope, but H.R. 2 is going to get nowhere in the Senate. You have no leverage to pass it.
And when it comes to the Senate, we will again push to gather these provisions. We have told the Democrats and Chuck Schumer, you don't have 60 votes to move forward on these bills if you do not do the border. And it may be a long waiting game, but he cannot get to 60 votes.
Interesting. And meanwhile, Ukraine is withering. We know Israel has a tremendous need. We also, by the way, we're following the latest. A juror has been dismissed from the Trump trial. They're down to six. Is speaking out right now on Fox, saying that she couldn't remain anonymous. Everyone knew who she was by yesterday. And number two is she doesn't think she could be unbiased. So I'm not sure what that means, who she was leaning towards. And they also dismissed 50 of 94 new jurors. What a circus in New York City. Also in New York City, what about the anti-Semitic protesting, the anti-Jewish, pro-Iranian, pro-Palestinian protests there in Columbia? Is that resonating in Tennessee? Are people understanding how outrageous this is in Washington?
They are, and we do hear things about it. I have friends that bring this up to me all the time, and as I'm out and about around the state, people will bring it up. And they can't believe that they would ever have somebody in the U.S. out in the middle of the street protesting for Hamas, for Hezbollah. They cannot get over this. And you do have these anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, pro-Palestine, pro-Hamas protests that are taking place. And whether it is on a college campus or the middle of an interstate freeway, people are just shocked. You know, Brian, I was on the floor actually Monday night again with my bill, Senate Bill 3168, that would immediately fund what Israel is asking for in the Israel aid package,
right,
which is money for Iron Dome and David Sling and Arrow and what they need to reinforce our embassy there. And the Democrats objected to that. And it is astounding that they are not able to separate these aid packages and look at them separately. The border is one issue, as is Israel and Ukraine and Taiwan. You can't throw it all into one bill. You have to take these up separately.
And I think that's what Speaker Johnson's doing. Let's see what Schumer does with in the House, because they have the same objective as funding them. So let's see if he's going to be compliant at all. Senator Blackburn, thanks so much.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I read Uri's letter and I never had the chance to meet him personally. And I wish in some ways that I had that chance so that we could have talked about what his concerns were. I mean, again, I don't have any editorial guidance on the newsroom, but it would have been interesting to hear and be able to think about structurally what can we do. So two of the things that I already talked about audience research. That's a big priority for us, understanding what it is that Americans need, understanding all the news needs of all Americans, because, as I said, that is our public mandate.
That is Catherine Moore, the new CEO, brand new CEO with not much of a journalistic background, talking about the regret she has that she hasn't had a chance to meet Uri Berliner because she suspended him for 5 days. And he's the business editor for 25 years of NPR, who decided, if you're going to suspend me for 5 days and not entertaining my legitimate criticisms over the last 7 years, then I'm out. He quit. So she expresses regret that he quit. How about bringing him in and talking to him before you suspend him? That might be an idea. Josh Holmes, former chief of staff to Senator Mitch McConnell, president founding partner of Calvary LLC, and co-host of the wildly successful Ruthless podcast. Josh, welcome back.
Brian, it is a pleasure to be here, pal. Great to hear from you.
So much to talk about, but I wanted to start there at NPR because this is a huge story for you guys at Ruthless. And for God, it means a lot for you personally, because the unfairness of the way NPR and some of their outlets, this guy comes forward and says, they became an anti-Trump organization. When the laptop was found to be real, said, I don't care, it hurts Trump. When it turns out the Russian investigation went nowhere, they said there's no mea culpa. There's no reevaluation of how we were led down this wrong path. So he wrote it, so they suspend him and he quits. So that means nothing changes, Josh, right?
No, I mean, that's exactly right, Brian. I also think it's important to note that Berliner is himself a progressive liberal.
Yes.
Right? I mean,
he's Blake Fillmore.
This isn't some, hidden conservative amidst the NPR. I mean, in his article, he talked about how he found 87 registered Democrats and not a single registered Republican in the newsroom. And he just felt the need to blow the whistle on it. Of course, that never works when you're dealing with a progressive mandate from the top, which this lady is the lady that runs the place, Brian, is about as crazy progressive a person as you can find. And the idea that she's running something like National Public Radio is truly amazing until you take a look at their product, and then it all kind of makes sense.
Chris Rufo just went back in her Twitter stream, and it turns out she's as anti-Trump as anybody. And she has a TED Talk out there where she's just ripping Republicans. So why would you – how did that not come up in the interview? Or did it help her get the job?
It could have helped her get the job. I mean, look, this is the rot that we've seen within this sort of quote-unquote mainstream or legacy media corporations. I mean, you see the same thing happening at the New York Times, at the Washington Post, the Associated Press at some level. It's almost as if the culture within these news organizations at this point has become so progressive. And there's, there's many reasons for it, Brian, but I think one of the reasons is they built an audience entirely upon the progressive base, and they just sort of keep feeding that audience. And you've seen, like, one of the things that Berliner highlighted was the change in the audience, which is what upset the CEO so much. They went from, it wasn't ever a balanced audience, but it certainly had representation on the conservative side, to virtually no representation at all, and it's just entirely progressive. And so they just keep trying to squeeze more blood out of the stone that is the progressive universe, and it is a really sad thing to see.
So, it's also unprecedented. It helps your podcast, I know, but we have a former president in court, and we have another president in Pennsylvania 3 straight days. He's trying to resonate with the working class, the union class. He was greeted yesterday by anti-Biden, Bidenomics protesters. I mean, forget about those anti-Israel protesters. If they hate Biden, they're going to really hate Trump. But what about the fact that the people are protesting the economy? He thinks he's going to be putting them on the glide path to the White House. What a disconnect.
The disconnect between the Biden administration and what people across this country are feeling economically is just absolutely incredible. And the thing I think that makes it so much worse for them is, he's not even close to the old Bill Clinton, I feel your pain type message. It's basically like, don't believe your lying eyes, right? Everything is so terrific, you just don't appreciate it. And you see guest after guests on places like MSNBC come up and basically echo that message. It's you don't have a bad economy. Your prospects are great. You just don't understand that. And it's like it's a messaging problem. It's like, no, pal, take a look at the bank account. It feels like a real problem to us.
It does. And I also think, just to update people, it turns out one juror has been tossed already. So we thought we were going to build on the 7 and said we're down to 6. She did interviews with she's a Sloan Kettering nurse, did interviews with MSNBC and Fox within the last 15 minutes. She said she didn't like the scrutiny. Everybody figured out it was her. And this is going to be a real problem. The judge then told everybody, told the press, don't keep describing people. Okay, good luck. What else do I do? We can't sketch. We can't bring in cameras. Stop describing people. Fantastic. And they tossed 50 of the 94 that were brought in today already. What a circus, Josh.
It is a total circus and a predictable one at that. I mean, everybody knows that this particular court in that particular jurisdiction is going to have a hell of a problem trying to find an unbiased jury. I think almost anywhere in the country you're going to have a problem finding an unbiased jury for somebody like President Trump, who's ubiquitous and known. And You know, if you love them or you hate them, you already have formed an opinion one way or another. You know, where do you find the people who don't have an opinion about Donald Trump? Like, I don't know. But it certainly changes what jury selection normally is. And I agree, it's turned into an absolute circus. Predictable, though.
Predictable. And he's going to be there from 4 to 6 weeks, and he's going to have to campaign on the weekends and on Wednesdays. Incredible. I don't really think it's that big a deal, Josh, though. In April, not a lot is done, correct? I mean, usually we're not even sure of the nominees yet.
Yeah, I mean, there's an awful lot of just sort of campaign infrastructure pieces that get put into place. And so candidate appearances are certainly not the priority in the early spring. And anything you're doing is certainly not going to stick for the summer months and into the fall when it really, really takes hold. So, yeah, I don't think it is hurting Trump all that much. I mean, clearly he'd prefer to do something other than sit in a courtroom in New York. But I think we've seen public opinion over the last, you know, year and a half treat all of this as sort of a dismissal. It sort of isn't relevant to the votes that they're ultimately going to cast, which I think in this case is probably good news for President Trump.
So, Josh, you're one of the most experienced people when it comes to legislation and how the Republican Party has changed. You know, Mitch McConnell is the outgoing minority leader. And we also know we have a brand new speaker, thanks to the ridiculous ouster of Kevin McCarthy. Is Marjorie Taylor Greene going to toss out Speaker Johnson because he's going to bring foreign aid to the floor? Here's what she said yesterday. Cut 19.
You have not yet figured out when you want to call up your motion as privileged because you're respecting the conference, but you're not ruling out doing it before the foreign aid bills come to the floor.
I can go ahead and rule that out. I can. I'm not going to call it before that bill comes to the floor because I think that bill is definitely going to tell a lot of people exactly what I have been saying.
She's going to back off. I'm not sure if Massey will, but it looks like Democrats will probably save Johnson if they're needed, because if they're getting what they wanted, $61 billion for Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific region, and there's going to be something on HR2 and the border. So I'm not sure how this plays out. Do you have additional information of what this looks like, and what do you think will happen in the Senate?
Yeah, I think they're going to end up bringing it up. It may be on a suspension calendar or not. I mean, in terms of Johnson and this motion to vacate, just recall the history of this as it dates back to the beginning of this Congress when people basically demanded that Kevin McCarthy include a motion to vacate where any one member could bring it up. It is the most imbecilic and completely ridiculous idea if your intent is to try to govern in any way. And the reason for that is you're never going to do anything of consequence. And I mean absolutely nothing of consequence under the dome in the Capitol that doesn't have a constituency that is against it. And particularly when you're dealing with something like foreign funding, you've got a libertarian wing of the Republican Party who's dead set against that kind of thing. But, you know, rather than casting votes on that kind of thing, they can hold this sort of Damocles over his head that says, if you even bring it up, we're going to oust you. And that is just a horrible way to govern. I think it's part of the reason we've seen a House Republican conference that has sort of been locked up on a number of issues over the last 6-8 months since they booted Kevin McCarthy last October.
It's crazy. Where do you stand on Ukraine?
Look, I think it's really important. I think if you think about this, take away anything that you believe is our responsibility there, you know, that people have differing opinions about it. But as a conservative point of view and somebody who, you know, thinks that President Trump would be a hell of a lot better in that office than President Biden in terms of executing over the turmoil that's happening both there and Israel with Hamas, the last thing in the world you want to do is roll in January 2025 with a set of options that included Putin rolling through Ukraine and Iran on just battering Israel, because your list of options that you're given are very short and every decision is very bad if those things happen. I think if you're a conservative and you look at the world right now, what you want to do is try to bridge the status quo as much as you possibly can to get some competent governance back, where you can make good decisions that are in the best interest not only of the American people, but our allies around the world, and keep American influence
good Lord, from receding any further than it has under the Biden administration.
Josh, in the big picture, I don't think there's any doubt what's going on here. The Russians and Chinese want a new world order. People might be concerned about the border, and they should be, but that's part of it. The Russians are creating havoc through cyber attacks, through misinformation, in order to get us at each other's throats. And they're also looking to expand their base in Eastern Europe. No doubt about it. They're looking to push us out of the Middle East. The Chinese would love nothing more. And having Taiwan and China, Taiwan be part of China, is also part of a new world order. They're looking to create havoc wherever we go. I mean, we have to own up to this story. The Washington Post story that talked about documentation, the Russians actually put this in writing, what they plan on doing. It's going according to plan. I think the American people have to be mobilized.
No question about it. And I think the vast majority of American people understand that, Brian. You've got problems on the left when it pertains to Israel funding, which blows my mind. You've got problems on the right with Ukraine funding because they would rather prioritize domestic priorities. But the issue is exactly as you outlined. This is happening. This is happening. And if you were to just allow Russia to just roll through Ukraine, the amount of damage that does, both in terms of what she would do as it pertains to Taiwan, but also our allies in Europe, and having them be entirely reliant on a reinvigorated Russia again. I mean, look, it took us an awful lot to try to get Germany and other countries out from basically using Russia as their gas station and being entirely beholden upon Putin. We've got to make sure that American influence around the world reflects that, or we're not going to have any markets. We're just not going to – the amount of damage that it does to the American consumer if America loses all of its influence around the world is incalculable. And I don't think people really sort of boiled all of that down to the point, you know, if we're talking about you're sending money to Ukraine and you're not doing that at the border – well, there's nothing that says that you can't figure out how to do both here.
Exactly.
And it would sure help. Right. It'd sure help if we had an economy that would produce too. But you're not going to get that under Joe Biden.
Right. Even though it's better than most other economies, even under this situation and the weight, you know, with building from the bottom up, that's great. So many rich people go to the working class and say, I need more money, or the middle out, which has never been done in any economics class. But the president talks about that when he does talk. Part of the reason you just explained it out. Other people, foreign policy experts, have talked about it. But the problem is we have a president that really can't talk to the press or the people ever. So we don't even know who's running the country. But we do know this. How about a great war story that probably never happened? Let's go back to yesterday. Cut 35.
My uncle, they called him Ambrose Brosey. They called him Bozy. My uncle Bozy was a hell of an athlete. They tell me when he was a kid. And he became an Army Air Corps before the Air Force came along. He flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea. And they never found the body because there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
Great story. Uplifting. I'm sure it doesn't add up. And now we're saying his uncle was eaten by cannibals? Couldn't that have slipped out in Wikipedia at some point?
I would think we would have heard of that at some point. Right? I would say that would have been somewhat of a noteworthy event in the history of Joe Biden.
You would have led with it on the Ruthless podcast.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, but look, the larger component, I mean, your listeners just heard him, you know, whatever story that he's made up today, and add it to the list, the dozens that he's just sort of conjured out of thin air over the years. But also just listen to his voice.
Oh,
like, this is the leader of the free world. How in the world? I can't believe the Democrats have tried to re-up this situation, right? I mean, this is the best they've got. Holy cow.
Josh Holmes, thanks so much. We got to get the Ruthless guys back on One Nation on Saturday. It was just a matter of getting the money work out. I know you guys demand a lot. So we'll to see if we could work out some type of direct payment plan. If we could Venmo you. Josh Holmes demanding money for his appearances. That's even a bigger story. Josh, look into your get 22andMe. I want to find out if you have a similar cannibal story in your past.
I'm gonna make one up. I'm gonna make one up if I don't have it.
I promise not to look into it. Back in a moment.
I'm your nightmare.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Welcome back, everyone. Just a quick announcement. April 27th, now it's like 2 weeks away, just 9 days away. Hope to see everybody in Henderson, Nevada. It's a History, Liberty, and Laughs tour. A chance to get on stage, talk about a lot of this stuff, but talk about history. We've got to reconnect with our past. It's got to be motivational, inspirational, and patriotic. And people have had a great time. We've done this about a dozen times. Pete has told me in confidence, not to mention on the air, but I'll do it anyway. It's better than Hamilton and much better than any musical, including Tommy, which is from Pete Townsend and The Who. So, and we have no singing, so we're not going to bore you with that. We'll get right to the point. So go to BrianKilmeade.com. VIP opportunities remain, and I hope to see everybody out there. One Nation Saturday night. We might be live for some of it because of the moving target we have on Saturday. We've got a great roster of guests coming your way, including Mike Rowe and more from the author of Bare Knuckle, the story of Bobby Gunn. It's going to a bare knuckle fighter with an inspirational All-American story, which has not been told often, but, man, it is moving. We also have video of the street fighting that might be taking place in a mall near you and might be one of the toughest, most impressive things you'll ever see. And he was the best at it. Now at 50 years old, he talks about it in his brand-new book. So it's going to be exciting, and as well as other great guests. So keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.